It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out why multitasking might be having a negative long-term effect on our brains.
First, for parents of newborns, the first few years of life can be an exciting and a challenging time. Between not getting a solid night's rest for what seems like an eternity to the first words and steps to eventual potty training, parenthood can try even the most patient person.
For many middle-class parents, they don't need to worry about a crucial item that a baby needs, diapers. In fact, many parents take for granted being able to buy diapers in bulk or having them delivered to their homes on a regular basis.
But for many low-income families, acquiring this basic necessity of parenting can be expensive and daunting. It leads some parents to delay changing times in order to stretch the lifespan of a diaper as much as possible, leading to potential health issues for the baby and the parents.
Recently, the White House Domestic Policy Council has tried to address this disparity by partnering with retailers and nonprofits to provide reliable, inexpensive access to struggling parents.
Joining us now to talk about how to address this gap is Cecilia Munoz. She's Assistant to President Obama and Director of the Domestic Policy Council at the White House. Cecilia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why did the White House tackle this diaper issue as a cause?
Well, we work on issues related to poverty and creating opportunity for all Americans. And in the work that we were doing, focusing especially on the neediest families in this country, what we learned was that one in three families in the United States have trouble paying for diapers. And as you pointed out, ends up either trying to make a diaper last maybe longer than it should. And that creates, think of it as a new parent, extraordinary stress when you can't provide for the basic needs of your child. And we also learned that the safety net programs, at least that the federal government offers, things like the food stamp program or there's a nutrition program for pregnant women, infants, and children, that those programs don't allow for providing diapers for needy families unless there is a change in the law. So, the president put a proposal in his budget to begin to experiment with ways to provide supports for families that need diapers. But we didn't just stop there. My colleagues who were working on this ended up connecting with a company sort of in this new economy, a company that called Jet that provides delivery services for a variety of things that people use, and they connected with a diaper manufacturer and essentially dug in to try to figure out a way to solve this problem. And they figured out a mechanism to make diapers available at a low cost to nonprofits that serve low-income families in a way that we think is going to get millions of diapers to families who need them all across the country.
We'll dig a little more into that solution in a moment. But first, any parent who's bought diapers knows that it can set them back a lot of money. But how big a hit is it for a low-income family? How big a part of their budget can that be?
Well, so we know that the average family pays about 33 cents per diaper, but the average low-income family pays 50 cents per diaper. And it can add up to almost $1,000 a year, which if you're a low-income family, is a lot of money and is almost twice as much as the average family pays. The reason for that is that the average middle-class family will either maybe drive to a big-box store and buy in bulk. That's what I did when my kids were little. Or they order from an online service that they have a membership for, and a big case of diapers will get delivered to their doorstep. Lower-income families are less likely to have transportation, less likely to be able to accept packages, less likely to have memberships in these sort of online services. So as a result, they end up going to the corner store to buy diapers, and the diapers are at an inflated cost. So it's the techies in my building think of it as surge pricing for diapers. People get outraged by that when it comes to transportation. And, there's no reason not to be outraged that that's true for low-income families buying a basic necessity for their kids.
Talking to Cecilia Munoz. She's director of the Domestic Policy Council at the White House and part of an effort to close what some people have called a diaper gap. Low-income families having a hard time affording the high cost of diapers, especially when they can't buy in bulk. They can't afford to buy a lot at one time, as many families do. So let's talk more about this solution. This is a kind of a public-private partnership, ultimately, Cecilia.
Yes, exactly. In fact, it's a private effort. The government got involved mostly in reaching out to the companies that then sat down and figured out a solution. So there's really, this is not a government project at all. We just kind of identified the problem and reached out to folks to help us find a way to solve it. So there's a company called Jets.com, which then reached out to a diaper manufacturer called Cuties, and they figured out how to take essentially the product without altering the quality, just figuring out how to fit more diapers in a box and to put fewer colors on the box as a way of saving costs. And as a result, they've come up with a product that costs about 13 cents per diaper. And very importantly, they're making those diapers available at cost to any nonprofit anywhere in the country that wants to distribute them to people in need. So there's a National Diaper Bank Network, which is going to avail themselves of this service. But importantly, this is available to any nonprofit. So any organization that's a charity can avail themselves of this and make these diapers available at a low cost to families who need them.
And then to complete these connections here, how do those nonprofits make sure that they're bringing in the people who are in need of this help?
Well, so a nonprofit can sign up with the company. They would go to jet.com/jetcares in order to sign up to become a diaper distributor. And that's the way that they can access the product. And then for folks who are interested in the Diaper Bank Network, there are three, actually, in Wisconsin, three diaper banks. Their website is nationaldiaperbanknetwork.org. And so that's the way you can find a diaper bank near you, where if you want to participate in helping others. But if you are connected to a nonprofit organization, to a charity, you can sign up to distribute diapers by going to jet.com/jetcares.
Let's bring on a caller. We've got Jason on the line in Eau Claire. Jason, hi.
Howdy ho, everybody.
Oh, what'd you want to bring up, Jason?
Well, I guess I was a little confused on this. I'm guessing that this is all about disposable diapers. My question is, what's wrong with cloth diapers? They do seem to be considerably more cost-effective. I understand they're not as convenient when you're out and about. Grab a disposable and throw it in a diaper bag or whatever when you're with the kid. But as far as these at-home parents that go through two or three diapers at home, I don't see the where it's the cost-effective issue.
Jason, thanks a lot. And Cecilia, this is a common controversy in the parenting world. I know, is this something that was an issue, whether these would be disposable diapers versus cloth?
Yes, and the reason we thought about it, and the reason that it's disposable diapers is because a lot of the families that we're talking about don't have laundry facilities. They have to go to laundromats. And in order for them to get to work, if their kids are in daycare, very often the daycares require that you use disposable diapers, which is why it's important to have disposable diapers that are available at a low cost to these families.
So another thought would be, you mentioned that support's available for food, things like the Women, Infants, and Children program, WIC, doesn't include diapers. Would that be another solution to have some kind of program like that provide help to families, and then they decide disposable or a cloth service or something like that?
It certainly would be, but in order for the WIC program or the SNAP program to be able to provide supports for diapers, Congress would need to act. So that's a conversation that we would like to start. But we don't like just waiting for Congress to act, even as we start the conversation, which is why, we reached out in order to find a private solution that can be moving forward now, even as we try to have a larger conversation in Washington.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about the timeline. Are these diapers starting to make it to nonprofits as we speak?
Yeah, so people are signing up now. Nonprofits all over the country are going to jet.com/jetcares in order to sign up. And the diapers will start getting delivered in time for Mother's Day.
Cecilia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Cecilia Munoz, Assistant to President Obama and Director of the Domestic Policy Council at the White House.
In our hyper-connected society, multitasking has pretty much become a way of life. We check our smartphones while we're watching TV, or maybe we check email while we're in the middle of finishing up a work project.
But our next guest says that while we might think we're being productive when we ping-pong from one task to the next, science shows that our brains are not keeping up and that by multitasking, we become less effective, maybe we even do permanent damage.
Calvin Newport joins us now. He's a computer science professor at Georgetown University. He wrote about the dangers of multitasking for Fast Company, and his new book is called Deep Work, Rules for Focused Success in a Distracted World. Calvin, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Well, with the arrival of portable technology, smartphones, tablets, it seems like pretty much we're multitasking most of the time. It also seems like we get more stuff done because of that, more stuff on the go that we weren't able to do before. But you say we're not exactly right about our productivity.
Well, I think it's important to divide the type of work we do into two categories. So in one category, we have what I call deep work, which is where you're actually putting your skills to their fullest limit, and you're trying to produce things of real value and real originality. And then you have shallow work, which is work that's easily replicatable, logistical in nature, perhaps necessary, but not actually producing a lot of new value in the world. I think we spend 99% of our time these days basically doing shallow work, and that we need to shift towards more of that hard, deep work that actually makes a difference.
And part of the problem seems that we treat them all the same, and we treat that deep work like something we can interrupt whenever we want to with the shallow work. What's the downfall there?
Well, people think that they've come a long way since the late 90s. In the late 90s, we actually used to do literal multitasking, where we would have an inbox open while we were writing, while we were talking on the phone. And we heard that that didn't work too well, that we're not actually good at doing two things or three things literally at the same time. So we've moved on to what we think is single tasking. But what's really happening is we're mainly working on something, but every 10 or 15 minutes, we do a quick just check. Let me just make sure there's not a new email. Let me just take a quick look at my phone. Let me just look at a political website, see if there's any election news. But research now tells us those quick checks, even if they're somewhat sporadic, leave behind a residue that can really reduce your cognitive capacity. So it's as if we have a whole generation of knowledge workers who are working with a severe self-imposed cognitive impairment.
It's worth pointing out that it seems like we've completely reversed earlier thinking about multitasking. A decade or more ago, we used to think about it as sort of a gift that you could really pay attention to a whole bunch of stuff all at once. And I remember articles about how women were better at multitasking. Women's brains were than men's brains. And that was a good thing. And now it sounds like everything is flipped.
Yeah, well, I think part of what's happening, too, is if we look at our economy, especially the knowledge economy, it's getting increasingly competitive. So the type of tasks you do when you're quickly flitting your attention from one thing to another, answering emails, setting up calls, jumping into meetings, jumping out of meetings, these type of activities don't produce a lot of value, so they make you less competitive. So if you spend most of your time, like a human network router, moving emails around, maybe you feel productive, but you should be worried because you're doing an activity that's easily replaced, automated, or outsourced. In other words, you're not really protecting your position in an increasingly competitive economy.
You mentioned interrupting our deep work can lead to a cognitive decline, and that's actually measurable. You write that it makes us literally measurably dumber when we keep interrupting our work.
Yeah, you can actually quantify, in some cases, the actual number of IQ points dropped. But I like the more broad analogy that the way that most high-level knowledge workers work today, which is where they don't go more than 5-10 minutes without at least glancing at an inbox or a phone, it would be the equivalent if you were working or running a factory back in the industrial age and you had thick gloves on all your workers that was making it hard for them to use their tools and they're making a lot of mistakes and not building the product very well. That's what's happening in this knowledge age. We have this self-imposed cognitive handicap, which means people that we're paying to use their brain to use value are only getting a smaller fraction of that potential value. And I think that's actually an issue not just for individuals, but for our economy in general.
I do want to talk a little bit about some of the brain science. What has science given us to know about what we do with our brains when we multitask? What happens?
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the original breakthrough work on this was done by the late Clifford Nass at Stanford, and he was really one of the first people to point out that if you do two things literally at the same time, you do them both worse than if you had done one and then the other. More recent research by Sophie Leroy on attention residue has been showing us recently that when you switch your attention from one target to another, there's a residue left in your brain that can last 10, 20, up to 30 minutes before it clears from the first target. And until that residue clears, you're working at a cognitive impairment. So that research is saying it's not just enough about to not have multiple things going on at the same time. You have to give a lot of time to a task, unbroken, undistracted time, if you really want to get the full capacity out of your brain.
Talking to Calvin Newport about multitasking and even sort of, serial unitasking, interrupting the main job we're doing. His book is Deep Work, Rules for Focused Success in a Distracted World. And Calvin, you mentioned in some of your writing on this that even it's not even just checking that email, being aware that there's an email that you want to check at some point in the near future actually can impair your ability to concentrate and be productive.
Yeah, an email inbox, it's almost as if it was designed to be as cognitively devastating as possible, because even if you just glance at an inbox, what are you going to see? You're almost certainly going to see at least one message in there that's important that you know you need to answer, but you can't answer right now because you're working on something else. from a neuroscience point of view, that's a devastating thing to know about, because there's now going to be a non-trivial part of your brain that's sitting there thinking about this email. What should we say? What should we write? I think a lot of people have this experience where they find themselves writing emails in their head as they drive to work or in the shower, and you're thinking, why am I doing this? This is not important. But our brain really fixates on the notion that there's a social expectation. Someone's waiting to hear from you. They want you to say something to them. So I think email in particular, and the way that we use it in the knowledge workplace, is having a massive impact on the productivity produced by the knowledge work sector.
Well, what should we do about it, though? I mean, we're not going to be able to turn off our email at work, at least not for huge chunks of time. So what's the best way to go?
Well, from the organization perspective, I want to be provocative, and I think we should. I think we're prioritizing the wrong things. We're prioritizing in-the-moment convenience that you get from having everyone with their own email address that you can access them at any time. But I'll tell you, if I was the CEO of a large, let's say, computer development firm, if I was running Google, the first thing I would do would be get rid of all of our programmers' personal email addresses. I don't want them to be accessible by email. I would want them to actually work on their craft and think hard. We can hire other people to figure out how to do the logistical stuff and make sure they know what they need to know. They need to know the HR, this or that. Let's get those distractions out of their head. I want them producing the best possible code. Now, for individuals, it is a little bit more harder, but the best thing you can do is schedule in advance as you go throughout your day, when is the next time I'm going to look at my email inbox, and then respect that time and make sure that that time gives you at least 1, 2, maybe even 3 hours at a go if you're working on something cognitively demanding.
Well, it sounds like you're also looking for a culture change at workplaces, even if you don't strip certain workers of their email. Nobody with email wants to have that, oh, didn't you read that email, or have you read my email yet, or something like that. And so that's a built-in incentive to always be on top of it and never set it aside.
That's right. The Harvard Business School researcher Leslie Perlow calls it the cycle of connectivity. She actually studied at the Boston Consulting Group how this culture of constant connectivity, how do I make sure that I'm always answering my emails really quickly at all times a day, how it arose. But an interesting observation from her research is that it was arbitrary. And I think this is true of lots of organizations. No one ever sat down and said, our organization will produce more money if everyone's very accessible by email. Typically, these type of work cultures just sort of emerge naturally based on just the idiosyncratic habits and people's tendencies. So I think we have a lot more flexibility than we might expect to make radical changes to these habits. And I think the first individuals and organizations that do stand to be at a great advantage.
Aren't we kind of going against the grain in some shifts that have happened because of technology too, though? I mean, people don't like to have as many in-person interactions as they used to have. They don't want to walk down and have a face-to-face with somebody or a phone call even, and that's what email's for.
Yeah, email is easier. And this is a big reason why it's been so popular. But here's the thing about work. Work is not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be meaningful, productive, and value-producing. By definition, work is not something that is what you want to do in the moment necessarily. It takes a lot of energy. It takes the application of craft. And I think too much of what we do, especially in knowledge work right now, is driven by what's easier for the workers, what's easier in the moment. And I think we should change the question around and say, what's going to be more meaningful and satisfying? What's going to produce more value? What's going to hone my craft more? So I think there's big changes coming. I know there's been this drive towards connectivity over the last 20 years. But once the first individuals and organizations begin to realize how much value they can reap when they actually try to optimize people's brains and optimize people's professional satisfaction and happiness, there's so much value there to be gained that once that Pandora's box is open, I think we're going to leave this age of email.
Calvin, to bring up a hypothetical, say you came to a Midwestern public radio network. I don't know, just pulling that out of nowhere. What would be the first step you'd make to start making that culture and that technological change?
Well, I think it's important to be more explicit about work processes. So one of the reasons why email in particular has become such a source of distraction is because instead of actually having specific processes fixed in advance, here's how we handle this task that always comes up, here's how we handle this very important part of our business, we instead sort of do it on the fly in an ad hoc manner over email inboxes. Just start sending emails, we'll figure it all out over email. And this requires everyone to constantly be checking and sending emails, or this whole network of dependencies grinds to a deadlock. So So I think one of the first things you can do to get out of there is start saying, well, what is the actual work that, I'm supposed to do? What's the actual work our organization supposed to do? Let's figure out processes for doing that work in advance. Here's when we talk about it. Here's how we move the information around so that we can start optimizing and say, well, this is the most effective way to do guest booking, and this is probably the most effective way to go over the in this hypothetical radio station, our topic ideas for our hypothetical show that runs from 3 to 6 p.m. Central Time, and say, we don't need to just figure this out over email. Let's have processes that we can study and optimize and get people using their brains to their greatest advantage.
All right, we've got a game plan. Calvin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Calvin Newport is a computer science professor at Georgetown University, and he writes about the impact of digital technologies on the world of work. And we've got that article that he wrote about the dangers of multitasking up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
Some food for thought there. I think, you know, when I'm, you know, hardcore doing some writing here or researching, I think I will try shutting down my email. Is that, it's hard to even say that.
Sounds like sacrilege, but well, you know what? We can try it.
I'll let you know as I enter this forbidden territory. The Department of Public Instruction released new data yesterday showing students in Milwaukee's independent charter and private voucher schools outperformed public school students on some tests.
The data comes from standardized tests and the ACT exam. It's the latest round in a long-running effort to compare the performance of charter, voucher, and public schools.
Joining us now to discuss the news is Alan Borsak, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, welcome back to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about this new data just made public by the DPI yesterday, kind of allowing some compare and contrast between voucher schools, charter, and public schools. What was your take home, first of all, from what you saw in those numbers?
Well, I'm in a kind of a contrary mood, so I think this is politically good news for voucher and charter people, and I'm all in favor of all test scores going higher, but I'm not so sure there's actually all that much to gain by looking at these numbers in terms of sector by sector, charters, vouchers, MPS. I'm much more interested in individual schools.
And let's, before we get too deep into this, I think it's always good to sort out what is voucher, what is charter, what is public. Can you give us the Cliff's Note version of that, Alan?
Yeah, well, that's a tough question, but I'll try. The public schools, Milwaukee Public Schools, is your classic public school system. That doesn't mean they haven't innovated and changed, but publicly funded, employed, teachers are all employed by the school district. Voucher schools are private schools. A very large majority of them in Milwaukee are religious schools, and they get money from the state under a program that's now 26 years old. The first and still, I would argue, the most impactful private school voucher program in the country. There's over 100 schools taking part. Charter schools are a little more complicated to explain. They are not religious. They are publicly funded. They're open to any student who applies. And they are run independent, at least the ones that get all the attention, are run independent of the classic school district, public school district. They're self-governed for the most part, or part of an organization separate from the school district. They are very controversial these days.
And one of the biggest controversies, Alan, and we've talked about this some before, is how do we figure out which one is working better than the other? How do we measure performance of public versus voucher versus charter? And these new this new data involves a few tests. What kind of tests are we talking about, and how do they work as measures of school success?
Well, that's part of the problem. We're talking about tests that were given almost a year ago, the so-called Badger test, which was a pretty ill-fated major undertaking by the State Department of Public Instruction. They spent several years getting ready for it, and before it ever was actually given, it had been torpedoed, so you'll never see it again. Schools right now are getting ready to do a round of a whole new test, the Forward test, which is from a different vendor, different, slightly different style of test. So the test itself and the age of the data are questionable. How reliable test scores are is certainly controversial. Personally, I think, and lightning bolts might hit me for saying this, I think they're a pretty good indicator of whether kids in a school can read and do math at the kind of levels you're looking for.
Also included in this data was the ACT exam. Now, this is something that used to be, you know, hey, you're thinking of college, you got to take the ACT. This is a college entrance admissions type of thing. This has changed. We're requiring more people, more kids to take the ACT now, aren't we?
Yeah, I should have made that clear. The Badger test and the Forward test we're talking about are for third through eighth graders. Mm-hmm. High school students are now taking the ACT. Just about every 11th grader in the state is taking them, and that's being used as the accountability measure, replacing the 10th grade test that was used for many years here. The ACT is certainly was set up as a college admission test, but it's being used now as an accountability test to figure out how kids are doing on a broader basis.
Talking to Alan Borsuk from Marquette Law School and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at new data out from the DPI that people are trying to use to compare charter versus voucher versus public schools. This is mostly in Milwaukee, but also, Alan, beyond a little bit, the state is expanding the voucher schools. It was Milwaukee, then it was Milwaukee and Racine. What do we have now?
Well, you've got a very matured program in Milwaukee. 27,000 kids are in voucher schools. You have a growing program in Racine. It's now in, it's fourth year, I believe. And that's growing, and it's about, as I recall, about 10% of the publicly funded students in the Racine United School District are going to school on vouchers. And you have just the beginnings of what could turn out to be a large statewide program. The legislature a year ago lifted a lot of the restrictions on its growth and where vouchers can be used, but that's actually too small to draw too many conclusions from at this point.
Well, I want to throw in some numbers. Let's look at these Badger exams. And you pointed out some people have called this, I think, a fiasco, the way this was rolled out and went. But looking at the numbers, 27% of students in the voucher program in Milwaukee proficient or above in English, compared to 25.6% of all MPS public school students in Milwaukee. It's not a huge difference. Is this something people are seeing as a significant difference?
Well, like I said, I'm inclined to think to some degree these results are more important for what they say politically, you know, that they give the voucher and charter movements a little more momentum, and we're looking to a new state budget a year from now. What they mean educationally, I'd say two things. Number one, to me, all the scores are too low. You're still talking about a quarter of the kids in the city who are not reading at a proficient or advanced level, so-called grade level. And even if you say that bar is set very high and lower it to the basic category, it's still a very large number of kids who aren't reading, doing language arts, and doing math at a level. And that's true in vouchers, charters, and MPS. So the differences just melt away before the bigger picture. And second, within all of those streams, you have some schools that are scoring way higher, sometimes because they have better socioeconomic student bodies and such, but sometimes because they're doing a better job. And you have schools that are doing particularly poorly. Within the voucher movement, I could point to schools with wildly different results, or widely, I guess, is better than wild. To talk about voucher schools overall is kind of hard. To talk about MPS overall, you've got some star schools, you've got a lot of schools that are really struggling. You got a lot of kids in the city who are going to schools in all of these streams who are really not doing that well and who have so many needs educationally and non-educationally. And I think we need to keep our eye on the big picture and come up with creative thinking about how to make fresh runs at the big picture.
One of the arguments for various kinds of school choice, whether you're talking vouchers or charters, was the idea that, okay, we're going to allow parents to choose. That's going to generate competition. That's going to mean that all of these schools have to up their games. The public schools will have to improve their services to keep from losing students to the vouchers and charters. Those schools are going to have to perform higher if they want to draw kids from the public schools. Have we seen any evidence that parental choice has lifted all boats?
You could debate that question a lot and find some evidence. It's certainly popular. If it's a question, do people like it? Yes, people like it. Every indicator, every survey, every just enrollment pattern I see shows that it's popular. There are no kids going to charter or voucher schools in Milwaukee, and we're talking to more than about 40,000 kids now who were assigned to do that. It really is a choice world. So it's popular. But is it working educationally? You could debate that for a long time, and the real answer is, as I said before, everyone needs to help, and the differences, if any, are really pretty small.
Right, so maybe we could argue about if this voucher is doing better than that public or whatever, but maybe choice hasn't been the magic wand that people were hoping it would be. It wasn't the cure for what's ailing education in a place like Milwaukee.
That's the most important lesson that's come out of Milwaukee. I mean, if you go back to 1991, when the program was being launched, you had education advocates who were talking about, and I'm not exaggerating the language here, but we've been looking for the magic button, and we're going to see it now in Milwaukee. There's one famous book that uses the word panacea. It wasn't that. A lot of the voucher schools are excellent. Some of them are the ones that are really, really terrible. Most of those have died out by now, but the mediocrity is still a big problem in that stream of schools, as it is in MPS. If anybody's policing their house more effectively, I think it's the charter sector these days and the weak charter schools. There's two of them closing as charter schools at the end of this year. One of them is going to go back to the voucher program. The charter sector is doing a better job of policing its schools and dealing with quality, and that's really important to pay attention to.
We're talking to Alan Borsuk about new data on student performance in public, charter, and voucher schools.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Does this news surprise you? Do you have a child in either charter or public schools and have a personal story to share? You can let us know what you think at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our discussion about new data that shows Milwaukee's independent charter and private voucher schools are outperforming their public school equivalents on recent standardized tests.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you part of this story? Do you work at or do you have a kid at a public school, voucher school, charter school? How do you see them all playing out? What's the answer? Is there a way to improve performance, outcomes for the actual kids in any or all of these institutions? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Alan Borsuk stays with us. He's been writing on education at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for a good long time now. We'll go to
way
our callers.
Way too long. Yes.
We'll go to our callers now with Jim on the line in Plymouth. Jim, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think, Jim?
I'm just wondering, what is the rate of the percentage of students that have special education needs in the voucher and charter schools? And do they talk about how that affects the quality of teaching within those types of schools?
Jim, thanks for that.
Public schools.
Thanks for the call. And Alan, I know this has been a controversial issue too. How does special education fit into all of this?
Well, good question and an important question. The reality, as best as I can judge it, is that the truth lies somewhere in between what the more adamant people on both sides would say. The voucher schools take more special ed kids than they're given credit for. My guess, and there was a study a few years ago that hit this number also, it's overall probably 8 to 10%. But that is, well, and it's not the 1% that some critics point to. But it's not the 20% plus that it's true in MPS overall, and especially in many specific MPS schools that have even higher rates. So MPS has a disproportionate share of special ed kids. I think that's just a fact, and that does have an impact. I don't accept that all special ed kids are not going to do well in school, and some it depends on what their disability is. But overall, those numbers indicate more challenging populations. I think that's just being honest. So MPS has a disproportionate share, and MPS has, as far as I can tell, a disproportionate share of the kids who are maybe not designated as special ed, but who are chronic behavior problems, too. So they get dealt a tougher hand, and that has an impact. But again, a lot of this varies from school to school. There are voucher schools that are very determined to serve special ed kids, and there's others that are eager to not. And the charter schools generally, there's some variation there, but generally they're much more open-minded about taking special ed kids.
Jim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Alan, we heard from Darlene on Facebook, who writes, this money going to voucher schools is every penny taken away from public schools, which if they had the money that went into these private voucher schools, it would enhance the public schools. And she says we wouldn't have two or more separate entities fighting for this money. Long story short, she says the public schools are losing out. How do those resources go from the public schools into these voucher schools, Alan?
Well, once again, it's far more complicated than that, and you can spin the numbers to look at it different ways, and it depends a little bit who you're talking about. If a student who would not be going to a public school is getting public money, that's fresh money. That's one of the real questions about the statewide voucher program. If it's a kid who would be going to a public school, you can make an argument saying this is actually saving the state money because the voucher payments and the charter payments are less than the cost per student of a public school kid. So much depends on the specifics, and the mechanisms vary from Milwaukee to the statewide programs. It's bad for any school, and that includes entire public school districts, including Milwaukee, to lose students. Declining enrollment is usually a bad sign, and cost does not go down so simply. You lose a kid and you lose having to pay for that kid. It's not so simple. You got a lot of fixed costs. You got a lot of incremental matters that are hard to reduce spending on. So declining enrollment is bad for any school, and that is hitting a number of public schools. But it's a really complicated financial equation.
We're talking schools, charter, voucher, public. Recent test scores out for the DPI. Yesterday, in fact, Alan Borsak is with us from Marquette University Law School, education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Go back to our callers now with Al on the line in Madison. Al, hi.
Hi. I was just curious about how many teachers we might have lost due to retirement or just leaving the state from collective bargaining, and if it affected public schools more one-sided than charter schools and such.
Al, thanks for that call. So different impacts of Act 10 on public schools versus the charters and the vouchers, Alan.
I'm glad to say I'm aware of two studies going on currently. One of them quite neutral and one of them from a more of a partisan group that are trying to really pin down more carefully what the impact of Act 10 has been. And I'm really eager to see the outcome of that work. Overall, it's pretty clear. I mean, the enrollment in teacher training programs around the state, university schools of education and such, is down all across the state. To some degree, it's down nationwide, but it's, I think, more so here. A lot of the evidence is anecdotal, but ACT nationally put out a study recently that fewer college students are interested in going into teaching. So it's a tough picture out there. I was at an event last week where the term teacher pipeline, bringing people into the world of teaching, came up, and all the educators in the room immediately perked up, you know, that this is a really big issue. So it's a concern, and my guess is it's going to become bigger as time passes.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Jeff online from Minnesota. Jeff, hi.
Hey. Hey, my question is the difference in rules, you know, relative to charter schools and public schools. The laws are different, who you can hire, you know, who can do the work, you know, how the game is played. And how do you square that?
Are you talking as far as, Jeff, employees, unions, things like that, certification, things like that?
Well, not necessarily unions, but, you know, for a charter school, you don't have to have an education degree and a license.
Gotcha. So different standards for teachers. Alan, how does that work in public versus charter versus voucher schools?
Well, charter schools do their own hiring, so they don't go through a central office like a school district school would. Some use that to great advantage and insist that having control over selecting their staff is a key to the quality of their programs and have demonstrated how that can be done well. Others haven't done it so well. The laws on discrimination and that kind of stuff are not really any different for any school. You still can't discriminate on the basis of most things. A religious school can hire people to teach religion classes who are from that religion, but that makes sense. But they can't discriminate in hiring general studies teachers. At least it's not so simple. As far as qualifications of teachers, I mean, some of the qualifications for public school teachers are being eased up, too. Generally, in charter schools, I believe it's correct that you have to have a college degree, but you don't necessarily, I think, and almost all the charter schools I know require a state teacher's license, but there is a little more latitude, and you don't necessarily have to have a specialty license to teach in that specialty, say, art or math or something like that, especially in a small school. A lot of the teachers teach multiple subjects.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We'll go next.
I'm talking about at high school level.
Sure, sure. We'll go next to Tim in Milwaukee. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, this is obviously, the voucher school movement is obviously a political movement. And it's a political movement to weaken the public school system and use it as just sort of a dumping ground for the kids that are extremely hard to teach or have handicaps or disabilities. And part of the reason is the conservative forces do not like the ideas that are taught in the public school. And I'm talking about things like conservation, environmentalism, and inclusion.
Tim, thanks for the call. So, Alan, we hear this from critics of school choice and things like that, that it's, in effect, an assault on the public schools.
Well, I'm going to pass on giving a judgment on that. Certainly there's politics involved, and in Wisconsin, the Republicans have been very much pro-school choice, and the Democrats have generally been anti-school choice. Even in those ranks, there's some differences of opinions. So, yeah, there's no question that a lot of this is political, but I don't think it's quite, you know, so simple to reach a conclusion. I frankly know people in the Republican ranks who are actually really out to help kids. They're convinced of that. I'm convinced of that. They're much more benign and positive than some people give them credit for. And the same I would say public school side, that they're more willing to help just kids. You know, one of the things that we've learned in Milwaukee is that sector by sector, it just doesn't make that much difference when it comes to quality, and that the focus more and more just ought to be on what can be done that helps kids. So when I see a school that's really working well for kids, especially low-income and minority kids, I don't honestly care whether it's an MPS or charter or voucher. I'm just really eager for such schools to flourish and to see more of them.
Good place to leave it, Alan. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
That's Alan Borsig, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.